Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now to something completely different and to my first guest, who became a global political phenomenon back in 2017 and the poster girl for a very new type of politics before walking away in a timely fashion. Former New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Listen, I was really struck reading your new memoir, A Different Kind of Power, about the amount of women in your life who had inspired you, your mum, your late grandmother, and obviously the former New Zealand Prime Minister, Helen Clark, who you'd worked with as a junior advisor. But one of your earliest political godmothers was an aunt who encouraged you into politics. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Oh, look, my Auntie Marie is a character I think that could probably warrant her own memoir. She had, an extraordinary life full of, significant difficulties at a young age, suffered significant burns to her body as a child from an accident. But as an adult really, noticed my interest in politics and was the first person who really placed me into a volunteer role that had that butterfly effect. Had it not been for that role, I'm not sure that I would have in turn ever found myself working in politics.
What's really striking as well about your family, Jacinda Ardern, is that service to others is a big part of your family background. Looking at your dad, who was a police sergeant, your mum, community and empathy was very important to them. What a lot of our listeners perhaps won't know is that you were raised as a Mormon. Was that a very important part of your identity when you were growing up?
Yeah, extraordinarily important. And I think when people ask you about, what motivated you into politics, where did your values come from? It's very hard to, allocate a certain amount to each basket of the things that happen in our lives. And I thought, rather than try and quantify anything, I'll just tell the story. I'll just share the story of all the different, influences in my younger years. And whilst in New Zealand, many people will have heard that I was raised Mormon, it was an opportunity to share what that really meant. And as a child, it was a big part of my life. And it was also a very, very small community. I was probably one of only 50 Mormons in the village, as it were. So it was also a core part of my identity.
Tell me about the faith of Mormonism. Obviously, I can imagine perhaps the door-to-door knocking might have prepared you well for your later life canvassing in politics. But tell me a little bit about the faith.
Yeah, well, look, in New Zealand, it's kind of probably not necessarily well known beyond New Zealand that there is a reasonable, outside of certainly the smaller towns, a reasonable-sized Mormon community in New Zealand. But my observation is that culturally it's quite different than what you'd find of the LDS or Mormon community in the United States. It's quite diverse, for instance. It's not necessarily, I would say, you couldn't necessarily say it votes all one way. But one thing that is very similar throughout any Mormon church throughout the world is that it is a church based on service. So from a young age, I'd be out, doing community projects. I remember the year that my mum made sure that we all learned how to properly ice Christmas cakes and would take them down to the old people's home and sing carols, or we would go and clean headstones in long forgotten graveyards. It was always a church that was looking for ways to make a contribution. And I think even after I left the church, because I couldn't reconcile some of their values around, for instance, homosexuality, whereas I saw the world as needing to be much more inclusive. Even after that, I'm pretty sure some of that inclination towards service never left me, even though I still can't ice a Christmas cake.
did you experience a sense of loss after you left? Because I suppose your leaving the Mormon church was coinciding with your real formation as what would ultimately become the prime minister that you became.
Yeah, it really was. It was a juncture of sorts. You're right. I mean, the point that I left, I was actually, in my 20s. And it was a point where in some ways I felt like all of that cognitive dissonance, when you've got two competing beliefs, I felt like I was picking a path almost. And I did find it hard. Writing the book, that was one of the areas that was amongst the hardest. And I think probably because it was a decision I took 20 years ago. And it was difficult. My family are still members of the church. And so I was leaving that behind. So writing about it was very tough, but I felt like it was something that I needed to figure out how to put on a page.
And that path to ultimately to the premiership of your country, in some senses, is very well documented. We know you broke so many barriers, Jacinda Ardern, in your time. You gave birth while prime minister. You were the first political leader to bring your baby onto the floor of the UN General Assembly. But another barrier that stood in your way is this anxiety and extreme sensitivity, an imposter syndrome that has stalked you your entire life.
And look, I over the years have certainly come across others in positions of significance who to varying degrees would express at some point in their careers having a confidence gap or a disbelief maybe that they have what is required for a job. I just don't think we talk about it. And we don't talk about it, I think, because we understandably have an assumption that that would lead people to, you know, lose their confidence in you as a leader. And that's, of course, so prized when you were trying to guide people through, for instance, difficult times. But I think one of the things that I became aware of the further I moved through my role is that some of those traits bring other traits. You know, being thin-skinned brings empathy. You know, having a confidence gap means you prepare. Being a worrier means you anticipate risk. You know, all of these things actually bring strengths. And so I certainly came to the conclusion that rather than seeing them always as weakness, they brought benefits to leadership. And perhaps we might seek some of those out a little more often than we currently have in leadership now.
Yeah, I see you dedicated the book to all the criers, the worriers and the huggers who will no doubt be so relieved to hear that you can actually, that there is a bit of a superpower perhaps in
Indeed.
Those things that we perceive as weaknesses. We all remember back in 2017 when you became the world's youngest female head of government at the tender age of 37. But your book opens with a less glamorous view of that time in your life, where you vividly describe sitting on the toilet at a friend's house waiting for the results of a pregnancy
yes.
test. We literally feel as if we're nearly with you as you counting the minutes and
yes.
as you're contemplating the enormity of this, not just for your personal life, but your political life. Just, you know, 7 weeks out from the election, you thought your party was in the toilet, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. And that was, I mean, it was one of the things that I really wanted to share, because I think behind the scenes, you know, people knew that, you know, my rise into the role of Labour leader was sudden. They knew it was immediately before the election. And they knew that when I came to announce my pregnancy, I'd obviously been pregnant for some 20 weeks. And so that must have come at some kind of time that was a bit awkward. But there was never an opportunity to share just the roller coaster of that period. And so the book was an opportunity to do that, to show actually the timing. You couldn't possibly have been worse. But in many ways, had it not been for that very sudden, unexpected position of running for Prime Minister when I least expected it, maybe I would not have held on to all of those things that I valued so much, or maybe someone would have tried to convince me that kindness, as I expressed it, maybe wasn't the right guiding principle for a government, or maybe I would have chosen, as much as one can choose, to postpone being a mother were it not for just circumstance. So I'm glad for all of those things, because it gave me a chance to experience the job in a way that I might otherwise.
Yeah, and your memoir really just kind of captures how much you can think about in those couple of minutes when you're waiting for lines to...
I feel like I should add for the listeners that the toilet seat was down. I was sitting on top of it. Otherwise, it feels relatively intimate.
As I say, Jacinda Ardern, it was a very vivid depiction of that moment. Like many people in the world and many people listening today, your path to pregnancy with your partner, it wasn't straight. Forward, but IVF did work ultimately for you and your now husband, Clark. What was that kind of experience going like? You know, many people just assume when they're teenagers and early 20s that this is just something that's going to happen when they want it to happen.
Yeah, and I probably, you know, growing up in a religion that placed so much priority and so much importance on family, I think I probably took it as a given. It wasn't an issue that really had, you know, come to the fore in my family history. So, I knew that, I was trying a little later in life, but it was a bit unexpected. And I think the reason I chose to write about those experiences was because so many people have them. And one of the things that we don't talk about is that when you are trying to conceal that you're going through that, it's really hard because it's all consuming. It takes up a lot of life, even just logistically, and even having to move between two cities was carrying all of the medication that requires refrigeration in this little green coolie bag that made it look like I was moving through an airport with an organ donation. Just the little things. But actually, as it happened, I mean, one of the reasons my pregnancy was such a surprise was actually I'd had multiple failed medical interventions. They hadn't worked. And when I became the leader, I just stopped because I thought, I just can't do that right now. I have to focus on the job. And that was when I found myself pregnant. So that was the surprise of it all.
You say in the memoir, it's only when people undergo IVF that they realise, like you and Clark did, that they are part of a larger community. And when you consider Jacinda Ardern, fertility rates are dropping. Many women and men are encountering problems with fertility. And I was just wondering, what do you say to them, and what conversations should we be having around that at a time when this has now become a socio-economic issue as much as a personal issue for anyone who is going through that experience?
Yeah, and I think this is where policymakers need to be really thoughtful. It is prohibitively expensive. And I think anyone would hate the idea that whether or not you're able to access having, the idea of building a family or not, just that mere act of being able to conceive coming down to your ability to afford it. I mean, certainly a lot of policymakers have taken efforts to try and ensure that that's not the case, but we should be very mindful of that. I also, I think increasingly though, I think couples will, and those wishing to have families will, I think, are probably beginning to understand that it can be complicated. It's not always a linear path, and building in a bit of time for that possibility as well. All I could do in the end, though, was share just the experience we had and the frustration of people telling you not to worry in those periods as
And
well.
also the speculation at the time when you were
Oh,
in the
yeah.
middle of these negotiations to see were you going to become prime minister,
Yes.
and these media, speculations about whether or not you were pregnant, was that a bit icky?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of those awkward things where if you're willing to talk about it, and I was, because people would say, initially I was a single woman in politics, and I would get asked the question, do you have a partner? Do you intend to have a family? And at that time, I decided that actually I wanted people to know who I was. I saw that as part of my job. So I would be very open about those things. But of course, as it became closer to actually genuinely trying to have a family, some of the speculation I found pretty difficult because it might be just that I got seen drinking a soda and lime, and that would prompt speculation. So having to be in that mode of denying something when sometimes it might have been something I wanted to happen, but it just wasn't working, that was awkward to say the least.
I know
Probably
you.
the most icky question I was ever asked, though, was when I conceived, what I thought was a step too far.
Far too far. I know you have Scottish blood through your grandmother, but
And Irish.
and Irish, because you gave your
Yeah.
daughter and you had a beautiful baby girl a very Irish name. Her name is Niamh.
Yes, oh, that was very deliberate. It was deliberate, both an acknowledgement of yes, we have strong Scottish heritage, but we also have Irish heritage. And my mum's a genealogist, so she can pinpoint exactly where in the family lines. But the choice of the name, we did so knowing it was an Irish name and knowing that it was connected to Irish legend and folklore, and that Niamh is the daughter of the god of the sea, and that really I think appealed particularly to my salty sea dog of a husband.
And he played a key role, didn't he? And look, I know, and the new documentary that's out about you, and there you are, the breast pump in the back of the car, kind of looking like Wonder Woman extraordinaire. But your husband played a key role. He was a primary caregiver during that time.
He was, and in fact, I really feel strongly about this, that I would hate for any part of my story or any part of even the documentary to try and create this notion that I was some kind of Wonder Woman. I only was able to do what I did because of the support I had around me. And I was very lucky to have that, but in particular, Clark. I just could not have done it otherwise.
Your time, Jacinda Ardern, as Prime Minister, like many global leaders at the time, was dominated by the COVID-19 pandemic. But your premiership was also dominated by the Christchurch mosque shootings in 2019, when New Zealand's Muslim community suffered an absolutely horrific attack after a self-proclaimed white nationalist opened fire on worshippers. 50 people killed, so many more wounded. And your response to that shooting is considered by many to be the defining moment of your time as Prime Minister. Can you bring us back to where you were when you first heard the news of that gun attack?
When it comes to crisis and leadership, sometimes there's just no warning and nothing that can prepare you. My memory of that day was I was in New Plymouth. It was the school strike for climate. We had a hydrogen conference, and then just out of nowhere, a phone call that there was a live shooter in Christchurch. And at that point, they weren't clear. Was it coordinated? Was it part of a multi-site terror attack? So you in the early stages exist with small pieces of information, but even amongst that, I still recall the feeling I had when I heard the word mosque, because you knew that it could well, and as it turned out to be, a very targeted attack. A white supremacist in our case, who hailed from Australia, who chose to target New Zealand because he believed it to be an inclusive place. And in the and his goal was to destroy that. And in the aftermath, you'll have read in the book that I saw it as an opportunity to share what it was like behind the scenes. And what dominates is just the experience of how incredibly humbling it was to be in close proximity to our Muslim community during that period. Their generosity in the wake of just such grief was incredible. And I think ultimately New Zealanders responded to that. So, yes, I led a response, but I led a response that I think was being clearly driven by New Zealanders and by our Muslim community.
You took a phone call that day from President Trump. Can you share with us what happened in that exchange?
Yeah, in the aftermath of events like that, it's common to have leaders reach out to offer their support, and that was the case for the president of the US in his first term, Donald Trump. And he asked the question, is there anything the United States can do for you at this time? And I gave the only thing that came to mind at the time, and which the only thing I could think anyone could offer, and that was love and support for all Muslim communities.
You vowed to deny the attacker the notoriety that he craved. You didn't want his name out there. You didn't want his manifesto out there. Why was that?
That was part of his ambition. His ambition was to. I mean, he live streamed the attack for the first 17 minutes on Facebook. He emailed widely his manifesto. And so, one thing we could deprive him of was the fame that he sought. And so, I vowed that I would never speak his name and that the focus should be on the victims of the attack, not on the perpetrator. And I would say that to this day, people would struggle in many cases to name who he is because it was a practice that many New Zealanders followed.
Why did you decide to step down when you were on such a high? It was such a surprise to many people when you ultimately decided to leave.
When people ask me the question, I think, oh gosh, did you see the last 5 years? I mean, it was a difficult time to be in office, but I would also hate to leave the impression that I somehow departed a conquered being. It was certainly wasn't the case. I think the thing that brought me into leadership was a deep sense of responsibility. And in the end, that's what took me away from it, because all of the things that I valued as a leader, maintaining your curiosity, just never being defensive, trying to keep that open mind, plus the energy that you need in reserve. I could have kept going, but all of those things were starting to erode for me. And then it started feeling like the responsible thing to do, knowing that was to hand the baton over, particularly because I was at a juncture where the next election was coming and I would need to sign up for another 4 years, and hand on heart, I didn't think that was the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think you said in your resignation speech, you cannot and should not do it unless you have a full tank plus a bit in reserve for those unexpected challenges, of which you had many. Jacinda Ardern, the progressive politics that you came to symbolise, kindness as power, empathy as strength, you know, appears to many of us now to be in decline. Are we living in a different world? Are we back into an era of macho, aggressive politics as a show of force?
Look, there's certainly a number of examples of that type of leadership in the world right now, no doubt. And I think the thing we have to be really clear-eyed about is that exists for a reason, but I think not the reason that many interpret. I don't believe that because that is what we're seeing in some quarters means that that is what predominantly voters are seeking. When you dig down, for instance, into the some of the analysis in the aftermath of the last EU election, where people perhaps switched their votes to parties that were on what we consider to be the far right, you see a relatively small proportion of them doing so because they believe in those parties' ideology. Oftentimes, what's dominating is a sense of disillusionment with the politics in their country, or a belief that politics is delivering, or it might be there's one singular policy that attracted them to that party. I think we do have deep insecurity right now, particularly financial insecurity, and people are looking for answers. And the easiest
and
trick in the book of politics, easiest trick for politicians is blame, othering, even to the point of blaming, for instance, multilateral institutions or some of those forces for where we are. Blame, though, doesn't bring solutions. And I do think ultimately that's what people will find, that unless that their lives start to improve or change, they will keep searching. In most recent elections in Canada and in Australia, we've had there two politicians who on their election nights reference the importance of value of kindness to them, their parties and their prime ministerships.
But do you accept, Jacinda Ardern, that the international order, the international rules-based order, seems to be really, really under threat now?
And I agree.
Conflicts can be started without, without seeking UN vetoes or permission or anything else. And in many respects, you know, people came to cast you as the anti-Trump, for want of a better phrase. And I'm just wondering, are you worried about that slip, perceived or actual, towards authoritarianism and dictatorship in the US, where you spend a lot of your time, but also more broadly for modern democracies?
For countries like ours, you know, the international rules-based order, consistency, you know, the power and importance of diplomacy in resolving conflict and addressing climate change and preventing future pandemics are all critical. And I really, really rebel and push back against this idea that the answer to today's problems is to further insulate yourself. Because actually, for most of the significant problems we face, you cannot do that. So in my mind, we do need reform of some of those multilateral institutions to make sure they're still relevant in people's lives. But we also need the bigger players, those who we've often relied upon to stick to that rules-based order, not to suddenly declare that it's over.
Can we rely on them? Can we rely now on the US, you know, previously seen as the world's policeman? Can we rely on those, you know, big players, the G7, to carry us through?
Well, I think we should maintain an expectation that they do. I think the moment that we just simply assume that we can't, that breeds indifference, and that's even more problematic. So I think we need to maintain the expectation, no question. Ideologically, at the moment, we have the leadership in the United States who takes a different view on their role in the world than what we've seen previously. But I don't think that means that we remove our expectation that actually we are all better off, and we've learnt the significant lessons of past significant wars. We are all better off when we maintain our eye on that collective responsibility as an international community.
You've been in the US quite a bit recently, obviously teaching at Harvard. And I'm just wondering, do you feel more nervous than you used to, you know, if you're passing through US immigration. Do you feel more nervous generally being there at the moment, given, you know, given the heightened politics that is unfolding there?
Well, I'm not a member of the faculty. I'm not at the centre of certainly what's happening and what is a tense environment, you know, no question. I mean, my mind actually turns to those students who, you know, are trying to make the decision about what they do, where they go, and the fact that ultimately in the roles that I've had in the past, it's been incredibly important to separate out the role that our universities play as a conscience of our societies away from any role of the state. That's certainly a principle I hold dearly to. So it is a difficult time, but yeah, it's not a time where I'm particularly focused on my position, much more so the loss for the world when international students and that international exchange of ideas is curtailed.
Because you availed of that, of course, in the earlier part of your career. I want to bring you back before I let you go to the very beginning, and it is the role of women in politics, because you were New Zealand's 40th Prime Minister, but also its third female one. And here in Ireland, we still haven't had our first. So I'm wondering, I know the systems are quite different, but you have any top tips, Jacinda Ardern?
Do you know, I think that the most important message of encouragement I could give is that things can change very quickly. You know, our first female prime minister in New Zealand was in the 1990s. And so, I mean, I grew up with not one but two female prime minister role models. And it meant that by the time I came into politics, I never believed that my gender would be an issue in becoming a politician and if I so chose. Moving up the ranks, you can very quickly change for a generation their assumptions about what's possible. We just need to start.
My last question, what do you want your legacy to be, Jacinda Ardern? Many people will distill it for you, but what do you want your legacy to be?
A belief that you can bring kindness into your leadership and be successful. That's what I hope for.
Well, it is a fascinating book. It's called A Different Kind of Power. It's published by Penguin and it's out now. Jacinda Ardern.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
So wonderful. Thanks for the chat.